from Pacifica. This is Democracy Now!
Hello to all my friends and fans in domestic and international surveillance. I'm here today because I believe that we can make a better world.
Today, a Democracy Now! Exclusive on the growing domestic surveillance state and the government's efforts to spy on journalists, whistleblowers, and activists. We host a round table with three targeted Americans. We're joined by former National Security Agency's William Binney. He served for over 30 years at the NSA, now warns its data mining program can create an Orwellian state. We'll also speak with Jacob Applebaum, former WikiLeaks volunteer, and Laura Poitras, the Oscar-nominated filmmaker. Both have been detained and interrogated scores of times when entering the United States. Their laptops, cameras, and cell phones have been seized. In November, a federal judge ordered Twitter to hand over information about Applebaum's account. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Two Chinese Muslim prisoners have been freed from Guantanamo after close to a decade behind bars without charge. The prisoners were among a group of ethnic Uyghurs ordered immediately released in 2008 after a judge ruled they were not enemy combatants. But they languished in prison because both the Bush and Obama administrations refused to resettle them in the United States, and plans for repatriation in other countries fell through. At least three Uyghurs still remain at Guantanamo despite the order for their release. The two freed prisoners will be resettled in El Salvador. Their release marks the first prison transfer out of Guantanamo in more than a year. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has urged the U.N. Security Council to adopt an arms embargo and tough new sanctions against Syria in order to force President Bashar al-Assad's government to comply with the U.N. peace plan. Clinton also announced plans to expand U.S. support for opposition groups inside Syria.
Start moving very vigorously in the Security Council for a Chapter 7 sanctions resolution, including travel, financial sanctions, an arms embargo, and the pressure that that will give us on the regime to push for compliance with Kofi Annan's six-point plan.
Clinton made the comments as U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon accused Assad of failing to honor a peace plan that went into effect a week ago.
Despite assurances from the government, there has been no meaningful progress on the ground. This is unacceptable. I call on the Syrian authorities to recognize the full urgency of the situation and permit UN agencies and international relief organizations to organize a major humanitarian field operation to help those people in need.
A bond hearing will be held this morning in Florida for George Zimmerman, who faces a second-degree murder charge in the February 26 shooting death of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. Martin's parents are expected to attend the hearing and could come face-to-face for the first time with Zimmerman. The Orlando Sentinel reports many local defense lawyers expect Zimmerman will be granted bond and given the opportunity to await trial outside a jail cell. In related news, Florida Governor Rick Scott has announced the formation of a task force to review the state's Stand Your Ground law. The right-wing American Legislative Exchange Council, known as ALEC, continues to lose corporate members amidst widespread public scrutiny of controversial measures it's helped push through state legislatures nationwide. Yum Brands, the owner of fast food chains KFC, Taco Bell, and Pizza Hut, has become the latest company to withdraw from ALEC. ALEC has come under pressure for backing voter ID laws seen as discriminatory toward people of color, as well as the so-called Stand Your Ground gun laws. There is a new development in the case of the police killing of 68-year-old Kenneth Chamberlain, the former Marine who was killed in his own home in White Plains, New York, after he accidentally triggered his life alert pendant. Attorneys for the Chamberlain family have identified the White Plains police officer who shouted a racial slur at Chamberlain prior to the fatal shooting. Attorneys said the officer, Stephen Hart, is also named in a civil lawsuit alleging police brutality brought by a defendant who said he was slammed down to the ground during an arrest 15 months ago. Federal aviation regulators have acknowledged dozens of universities and law enforcement agencies have been given approval to use drones inside the United States. The list includes the Department of Homeland Security, Customs and Border Protection, various branches of the military, defense contractor Raytheon, drone manufacturer General Atomics, as well as numerous universities. Police departments with drone permits include North Little Rock, Arkansas, Arlington, Texas, Seattle, Washington, Gadsden, Alabama, and Ogden, Utah. The FBI has seized a computer server at a New York facility shared by the internet organizations Rise Up Networks and May 1st People Link. The server was operated by the European Counter Network and ran a program called Mixmaster, which routes emails through anonymous servers in a network. The server also ran a number of mailing lists and websites for political groups. Jamie McClellan of May 1st said, quote, "The server seizure is not only an attack against us, but an attack against all users of the internet who depend on anonymous communication." The server was seized as part of an FBI investigation into the bomb threats against the University of Pittsburgh. A new government-backed study has found there's no evidence the death penalty acts as an effective deterrent to violent crimes. In a sweeping review of previous studies, the National Research Council found researchers have failed to draw a link between capital punishment and the prevention of murders. The review found there's insufficient data on how potential murderers may perceive the risk of execution as a likely consequence. Vermont has become the third state to urge Congress to repeal the Supreme Court's controversial Citizens United ruling that affirmed personhood rights for corporations. On Thursday, the Vermont House followed the state Senate in backing anti-Citizens United resolutions passed in over two dozen towns statewide last month. Hawaii and New Mexico have approved similar measures. A new study shows one in four working-age Americans were without health insurance at some point last year. According to the Commonwealth Fund, 26% of adults below the age of 65 lacked insurance during 2011, a percentage equal to around 48 million people. 7 out of 10 who lost insurance reported spending at least a year without coverage because the price of obtaining new insurance was too unaffordable. The European Union has agreed to share the private information of passengers flying from Europe to the United States with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. On Thursday, the European Parliament approved a pact that'll grant U.S. access to passengers' date of birth, credit card information, seat number and dietary preference prior to departure. European lawmakers had waged a five-year campaign to scale back the sharing of passenger data with U.S. authorities. Pro-democracy protests continue to flare in Bahrain ahead of this week's Formula One Grand Prix. On Thursday, Bahraini forces fired tear gas and stun grenades at hundreds of protesters in the capital, Manama. Bahraini human rights activist Nabil Rajab criticized the Formula One organizers for hosting their race amidst the ruling Sunni monarchy's crackdown.
We are not against Formula One because we are against Formula One. Every part of our nation lacks to enjoy the sport. But we are against awarding dictators. Formula One in Bahrain has been taken as a PR for the ruling elite, the repressive dictators who are ruling the country.
Proponents of the Keystone XL pipeline that would bring crude oil from Alberta's tar sands to the Gulf Coast are picking up increasing Democratic support. This week, the House passed a measure that would expedite the pipeline's approval, with 69 Democrats joining with the Republican majority. The White House has vowed to veto the bill should it reach President Obama. The Obama administration sought to delay a decision on the pipeline until after the 2012 election. The phone hacking scandal that's rocked Rupert Murdoch's media empire is expanding on U.S. soil. Lawyer Mark Lewis, who helped expose the massive scandal in Britain, said he's partnering with U.S. lawyer Norman Siegel, who's been investigating the possible hacking of 9/11 victims' cell phones by the British tabloid News of the World. While Lewis said many complaints against News Corp in the United States stem from the now-defunct tabloid, he also said there have been initial allegations against Fox News and other News Corp holdings. Lewis said he's now representing four clients who believe their phones were hacked while visiting the United States.
What they're alleging is that they either left messages or received messages, and that their messages were therefore listened into or investigations were sourced. See, what you have to understand is if one person is speaking to another person, the very fact that they're even speaking to each other is potentially news. You know, if you have somebody who is having an adulterous relationship with another person, the very fact that they're speaking to each other is what you as a journalist, if you're writing about a relationship, is what you need as a primary source or a secondary source. It doesn't really matter what they say.
Today marks the second anniversary of BP's Deepwater Horizon oil rig explosion that killed 11 workers and sent nearly 5 million barrels of oil gushing into the water in the worst maritime oil spill in U.S. history. The impact of the disaster still remains, as scientists say. Shrimp, fish and crabs in the Gulf of Mexico have been deformed by chemicals released during the spill. One commercial fisherperson told Al Jazeera that half of shrimp caught during the last white shrimp season were eyeless. Others reported finding clawless and mutated crabs. A new report released this month found that a toxic blend of crude oil and dispersant called Corexit is not degrading, as some had hoped. The report also found that toxins penetrate wet human skin faster than dry skin and can be observed in skin under UV light. Nearly 2 million gallons of Corexit were used to disperse the oil, although it was later revealed the chemical made it more difficult for microbes to naturally digest oil. Oil giant BP recently settled with victims of the spill for an estimated $7.8 billion over medical claims and economic losses in one of the largest class action settlements in history. And Lavon Helm has died at the age of 71 after a battle with cancer. He was a drummer and singer in Bob Dylan's backup band, The Band, which later became the legendary musical group known simply as The Band. Lavon Helm appeared in the 2009 documentary Back to Woodstock, directed by Julie Cohen.
In 1969, we had just signed a recording agreement with Capitol Records. The odds were in
my favor. Lavon Helm, drummer and singer in The Band, was a natural fit for the festival. He and his bandmates were already living in the Catskill Mountains north of New York City, in the little town of Woodstock, New York.
A lot of the people here play music anyway. So, you know, you go into the gas station, the guy that's helping you fill your car up, he may be the best banjo picker around, you know. So people around here have always celebrated music.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Today, we bring you a Democracy Now! Special on the growing domestic surveillance state and the Department of Homeland Security's efforts to spy on dissident journalists and activists. In a national broadcast exclusive, we're joined by National Security Agency whistleblower William Binney. He was a key source for James Bamford's recent exposure in Wired magazine about the NSA, how the NSA is quietly building the largest spy center in the country in Bluffdale, Utah. The Utah Spy Center will contain nearly bottomless databases to store all forms of communication collected by the agency, including private emails, cell phone calls and Google searches and other personal data. Binney served in the NSA for over 30 years, including a time as director of the NSA's World Geopolitical and Military Analysis Reporting Group. Since retiring from the NSA in 2001, he has warned that the agency's data mining program has become so vast that it could, quote, create an Orwellian state. Today marks the first time Binney has spoken on national television about surveillance by the National Security Agency.
We're also joined by two individuals who've been frequent targets of government surveillance, Laura Poitras, the Academy Award-nominated filmmaker, and Jacob Applebaum, a computer security researcher who has volunteered with WikiLeaks. Poitras is the director of the documentary films My Country, and The Oath. Both Poitras and Applebaum have been repeatedly detained and interrogated by federal agents when entering the United States. Their laptops, cameras and cell phones have been seized, and presumably their data has been copied. The Justice Department has also targeted Applebaum's online communications. In November, a federal judge ordered Twitter to hand over information about his account. In October, The Wall Street Journal revealed the Justice Department had obtained a secret court order to force Google and the internet provider Sonic.net to turn over information about Applebaum's email accounts. William Binney, Laura Poitras, and Jacob Applebaum will be speaking tonight at the Whitney Museum here in New York for a teach-in on surveillance. The three of them join us here in our studio together in a broadcast for the first time. We're going to begin with William Binney. You worked for the National Security Agency for more than three decades.
Almost four decades.
Yeah. You, for a time, directed the NSA's World Geopolitical and Military Analysis Reporting Group. Tell us what you did, and then why you left and what happened to you afterwards.
Well, I was the technical director of that group that basically looked at the world. So we looked at all the technical problems of in the world and see how we could solve collection, analysis, and reporting on military and geopolitical issues all around the world, every country in the world. So it was a rather large technical problem to tackle, but and one of the largest problems we thought we had was looking at the World Wide Web and all the ballooning and mushrooming communications in the world, and our ability to deal with that was diminishing over time. So I kind of referred to it as our inability to keep up with the rate of change. So we were falling behind the rate of change. So I had a very small group of people in a lab, and we decided to attack that problem. We did it by looking at how we could graph the network of communications and all the communications in the world, and then focus in on that graph and use the graph to limit what we wanted to attack. And we basically succeeded at that. But in the process, of course, we scooped up Americans from different places, so we had to protect their identities according to our laws and privacy rights of U.S. citizens. So under UCIT 18, we built in protections to anonymize their identities, so you couldn't really tell who you were looking at.
And that's because the NSA could do surveillance from abroad, but not of U.S. citizens.
Well, and you see, the World Wide Web routes things all over, so you never really know where U.S. citizens' communications are going to be routed. So if you were collecting somewhere else in another continent, you could still get U.S. citizens. That was a universal problem. So we devised how to do that and protect U.S. citizens. So, and this was all before 9/11. We devised how to do that, made that effective and operating. So we were actually prepared to deploy about 8 months before 9/11 and actually have a system that would run and manage the what I call 20 terabytes a minute of activity. But after 9/11, all the wraps came off for NSA, and they decided to between the White House and NSA and CIA, they decided to eliminate the protections on U.S. citizens and collect on domestically. So they started collecting from a commercial, the one commercial company that I know of that participated, provided over 300, well, probably on the average about 320 million records of communication of a U.S. citizen to a U.S. citizen inside this country.
What company?
AT&T. It was long-distance communications. So they were providing billing data. At that point, I knew I could not stay because it was a direct violation of the constitutional rights of everybody in the country. Plus, it violated the Penn Register Law and Stored Communications Act, the Electronic Privacy Act, the Intelligence Acts of 1947 and 1978. I mean, it was just a whole series of plus all the laws covering federal communications governing telecoms. I mean, all those laws are being violated, including the Constitution, and that was a decision made that wasn't going to be reversed, so I could not stay there. I had to leave.
I wanted to get back to for a moment when you say that you were developing a way to cope with the fact that the agency was falling behind, just because the sheer volume of the material they were sweeping up was so great that it was impossible at times to find the important intelligence material. So you, in essence, were creating a program that filtered out the valuable stuff.
That's right.
What did it have a name, the program?
Well, it was called Thin Thread. I mean, Thin Thread was our a test program that we set up to do that. By the way, I viewed it as we never had enough data. Okay, we never got enough. It was never enough for us to work at, because I looked at velocity, variety, and volume as all positive things. Volume meant you got more about your target. Velocity meant you got it faster. Variety meant you got more aspects. These were all positive things. All we had to do was to devise a way to use and utilize all of those inputs and be able to make sense of them, which is what we did.
And when they didn't use your system, the NSA developed another, or attempted to develop another system?
Well, that one failed. They didn't produce anything with that one.
And that one was called?
Trailblazer.
Yeah. And Trailblazer.
I called it five-year plan number one. Five-year plan number two was turbulence.
And Trailblazer cost how much money?
I think my sense was a little over $4 billion.
$4 billion.
Right.
But it was scuttled. It was done away with in 2006.
Yes, I think it was. But yes, that's right. And we developed our program with $3 million, roughly.
Trailblazer was largely developed by SAIC?
They were contributing contractors, yeah. But they were the lead contractors in some of the contracts, yeah.
And why did they go with this one, though ultimately they did not use it? This is under Michael Hayden at the time?
Yes. Well,
under the Bush administration?
Well, I thought my sense was it was a good employment program, and it was a large budget program. They would spend money, a lot of money, so it would build a budget and
go to a major weapons manufacturer,
right.
And heads of the agency, National Security Agency, would go back and forth working at NSA,
SAIC. We called it an incestuous relationship, yeah.
What happened to you after you quit? You quit within a month of the 9/11 attacks.
31st of October of 2001, yeah.
And then what happened?
Well, we tried to form up a company to at least help the government to deal with some of the massive data problems they had, like even in the FBI, and also Customs and Border Protection and NRO and various other agencies. And every time we went somewhere to try to develop something, we got canceled. Our contract got canceled because we have heard that they were told that certain agencies didn't want them hiring us, so they didn't want us working for them. So,
and before you left in that short period, when it became obvious to you the direction that the NSA was going to, when you raised objections or concerns, what was the response?
Well, I went directly to the Intelligence Committee. Because it was their job to—because, first of all, when that happened, I mean, the people they had to use to set it up, since they used part of the program we developed to set it up, they had to use our people to set it up initially, because no one else knew the code and no one else knew how to get it operating. So when they did that, those people came to me and said, you know, they're doing this, you know, and they told me what they were doing. And so I immediately went to the Intelligence Committee, because the Intelligence Committees were formed to have oversight over the intelligence community to make sure they didn't monitor U.S. citizens. This was a fallout of the Church Committee back in the 70s. The member of the staff that I went to Porter Goss, who was chairman of that committee at the time, and he referred her to General Hayden for any further. When it was the job of that committee to do the oversight on all this domestic spying, and they weren't doing it, okay? Basically, at the time, according to Dick Cheney's interview on the 10th anniversary of 9/11, he said at that time, only the majority and minority leaders of the HPSI and the CISI were involved in having knowledge about this program, Stellar Wind, which you had talked with Tom Drake about.
The former NSA employee who is also a whistleblower.
And that was the program, of course, that Director Mueller reported was the issue that with the hospital visit with Ashcroft.
Explain that very briefly to remind people.
Well, the whole program had to be reauthorized every 45 days, and they had to have the director of NSA, the director of CIA, and the attorney general sign an affidavit that they still needed the program, and it was legal. And when Comey and Goldsmith in the DOJ decided that this really was a violation of the Constitution and was illegal— Then that issue came up, and that's what got everybody kind of disturbed and ready to resign in 2004, early 2004, I believe that was. And as a part, it was coming up for reauthorization, and so Gonzalez left the White House along with one other person, I can't remember, and went to the hospital where Ashcroft was, because he had pancreatitis, I believe, and was in the hospital, and Comey was acting attorney general. And so at that point, they went to Ashcroft to see if he would overrule Comey, who had denied a reauthorization and declared it basically illegal. And so they tried to get Ashcroft to overrule that and went to the hospital to do that. And Director Mueller, I think, also quickly got to the hospital to help ensure that Ashcroft was not taken advantage of, I guess. So,
when was your home raided?
26th of July of 2007.
What happened? Where did you go?
I should say that it was the morning of the second day after Gonzalez's testimony, the then Attorney General Gonzalez's testimony to the Senate Judiciary Committee on the TSP, the what was called the TSP, which I referred to as a fabricated plan. It was created to cover a number of plans, one of which was Stellar Wind, and the others, which they didn't want to discuss, and the others were wiretapping. And so they picked on the wiretapping ones because the public would generally say, yes, anybody that was potentially a terrorist, a foreign terrorist, communicating with anybody in the United States, we want you to monitor their communications. So that was the acceptable part of it, but it was grouped with Stellar Wind and some other programs. So that they could give cover to it, talk about some programs, say they're talking about the terrorist surveillance program. But it was basically a group of programs, some of which they did not want to talk about. And he did not testify to that at the and I believe some of the White House and Feingold, I think, were the two who were on the Senate Intelligence Committee that did challenge him at the time, saying he wasn't being truthful and that he wasn't being completely honest. So,
you live where?
I live in Maryland, actually 4 miles from NSA.
And what happened?
They came busting in.
Who's that?
The FBI, about 12 of them, I think, 10 to 12. They came in with the guns drawn on my house.
Where were you?
I was in the shower. I was taking a shower. So my son answered the door, and they, of course, pushed him out of the way at the gunpoint and came running upstairs and found me in the shower and came in and pointed a gun at me while I was, you know—
Pointed a gun at your head?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Wanted to make sure I saw it and that I was duly intimidated, I guess.
And what did they do at that point? Did they begin questioning you, or they just took you to headquarters? Or?
No. Yeah, they basically separated us from I was separated from my family. They took me on the back porch, and they started asking me questions about it. They were basically wanting me to tell them something that would implicate someone in a crime. And so I told them that I didn't really know. They wanted to know about certain people. They were the ones that were being raided at the same time. People who we all signed—those who were raided that day, all of us signed the DODIG complaint. We were the ones who filed that complaint.
The Pentagon DODIG complaint.
Against NSA, yes. Talking about fraud, basically corruption, fraud, waste, and abuse.
Tom Drake was raided at the same time.
No, he was raided in November of that year. We were just the ones who signed it were raided.
So who were the other people that were raided that same day?
Diane Rourke, Kirk Wiebe, and Ed Loomis.
Diane Rourke worked for the Senate committee.
Diane was the senior staffer. She had the NSA account on the HPC side, on the House side. So she was monitoring, she was doing oversight. She was doing real oversight. The others weren't. Basically, the others were simply taking what the NSA said verbatim and taking them at their word. So basically, that was not oversight. But Diane would probe and be prying into the what they were saying to find out really clearly what was going on.
And ostensibly, they were searching for who was leaking information to the who had leaked information to the New York Times.
That was the pretext, yes. But I accused them of being sent there by someone outside the FBI, and that their body language told me that I hit it right on the head. So, and I also after a while, they were questioning me. I couldn't tell them anything because I didn't know anything that would implicate any of the four of us. So.
They were looking for leaks.
That was the pretext, the leak on the—to give the New York Times thing. What they were really doing was retribution and intimidation, so we didn't go to the Judiciary Committee in the Senate to tell them, well, here's what Gonzalez didn't tell you, okay? That was what it was really all about. And also, it was retribution for that DOD IG complaint, because it was a rather embarrassing report that they gave, so.
And what is it that Gonzalez didn't tell them, in your perspective, in terms of what is happening to our national security surveillance situation?
Well, it was about Stellar Wind and all of the domestic spying.
We're going to break and come back to this conversation. William Binney was the technical director of the National Security Agency, which, by the way, is a number of times larger than the CIA, the National Security Agency's World Geopolitical and Military Analysis Reporting Group. When we come back, we'll also speak with well-known hacker Jacob Applebaum, who has volunteered for WikiLeaks. He's a computer security researcher. And Laura Poitras, whose films My Country, My Country and The Oath are well-known. She's been nominated for an Oscar. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Watch your mind, gotta open it up, don't know who's been in it, tracking where I go, finding out all my business, secure, tick, video cameras locked on me, in every dressing room, on every floor, in every store, damn, can I get that democracy and equality and privacy, you busy watching me, that you're blind, baby, you neglect to see the drugs coming into my community, weapons coming into my community, dirty cops in my community, and you keep saying that I'm free, and you keep saying that I'm free, and you keep saying that I'm free, busy watching me.
Watching Me by Jill Scott. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guests are William Binney, who is technical director of the NSA's World Geopolitical Military Analysis Reporting Group. He worked with the NSA for almost 40 years, National Security Agency. We're also joined by Laura Poitras, the Oscar-nominated filmmaker, and Jacob Applebaum, computer security researcher. You two have something in common with each other. Every time you come into the United States by plane, you are stopped, you are searched, you are interrogated. Laura Poitras, tell us about your experience, your latest one.
Right. Well, I mean, I've been stopped at the border since 2006, since I started working on a series of films looking at U.S. post 9/11. And so I've actually lost count to how many times I've been detained at the border, but it's, I think, around 40 times.
And 4-0.
4-0, right. And on this particular trip, lately they've been actually sending someone from the Department of Homeland Security to question me in the departing city. So I was questioned in London about what I was doing. I told them I was a journalist and that, you know, my work is protected and I wasn't going to discuss it. And then on this particular occasion, I landed at Newark Airport. And what they do when I'm flying, they do passport control inspection at the gate. So they make everyone who's deplaning show their passport. And so that's how they...
Well, they don't even wait for you to get to immigration.
No, I don't get into immigration. I get the escorted treatment.
So they make everyone show their passport until they get to you.
Right.
And then they take you off
and
the plane.
And then they take me away. And then I'm escorted first through immigration. And so this has been going on. I've been through this several times and kind of know how it goes. But what happened on this particular trip, which was very disturbing. So
just a few weeks.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was met by two agents at Newark. One of them is Agent Wassum. And when they met me, I took out my pen and paper to note their names and the time. And because I've always taken notes, so I have a record of the questions that I'm asked and how long I'm detained for, what's the focus of the interrogation, what they're doing to me. And on this occasion, I took out my pen, and I was ordered to put away my pen. And I didn't, and I continued to take notes. And I was ordered again to put away the pen, and I didn't. And then he threatened to handcuff me for not putting away my pen. And at that point, I put away my pen and then walked to immigration and took out my pen again to take notes, was ordered again to put away my pen, and then was taken into secondary screening and asked to speak to a supervisor, explained I was a journalist, explained that legal counsel has told me that I should be taking notes of my detention and interrogation, and then I was told that I couldn't take notes, that I was free to take notes after I was finished being questioned.
The theory that what, the pen was a weapon?
Oh, yeah, that's right. They said that my pen was a dangerous weapon. So that's Agent Lawson who said that my pen was a threat to them. And you know, I mean, in terms of the context, you have to understand that I'm surrounded by border agents who are all carrying guns, and I'm taking out a pen that they find threatening. And so this was, you know, profoundly upsetting, and then I was taken directly into an interrogation room and questioned. I took out my pen again. I was ordered by another agent to put it away, and this went on for quite some time, and I was told during this interrogation. I'm always asserting my rights as a journalist to not reveal my work, my sources.
You did a film on Yemen. You did a film on Iraq.
Yeah. And so this detention started after I finished the first film in 2006, which was about the occupation of Iraq. And I was told that I was refusing to cooperate with an investigation. And then he said, well, it wasn't an investigation. It was questioning, but that I was refusing to cooperate. And then I asserted my rights, that actually asserting one's rights is not refusing to cooperate. And so this went on for quite some time. And it's something that's been happening for a while, and I've talked about it publicly, but also have been hesitant to, because I don't want to jeopardize the work that I do.
And took your computer.
Not on this trip. No,
they've taken your computer.
Yeah, on one occasion they took my computer.
They've taken your phone.
Yeah. On one occasion, it was right after, a few days after maybe a week after Jacob's computer was detained.
Democracy Now! Contacted the Department of Homeland Security for an explanation of why you were detained and interrogated at the airport on April 5th. We received a reply from Anthony Bucci, the public affairs specialist, that's BUCCI, in New York City for U.S. Customs and Borders Protection. He emailed, quote, "Due to privacy laws, U.S. Customs and Border Protection is prohibited from discussing specific cases." He went on to write, quote, "Our dual mission is to facilitate travel in the United States while we secure our borders, our people, and our visitors from those that would do us harm, like terrorists and terrorist weapons, criminals, and contraband." He did not answer our additional questions.
Well, I guess I should add journalists to that list.
Jacob, your experiences entering the United States at various times?
After the summer of 2010, my life became a little hectic with regard to flying. I do a lot of traveling working with the TOR project. And after the summer of 2010, where I gave a speech at Hackers on Planet Earth in place of Julian Assange, I was targeted by the U.S. government. And essentially, until the last four times that I've flown, I was detained basically every time. Sometimes men would meet me at the jetway, similarly with guns.
Let us play that moment when you went to the HOPE conference, Hackers on Planet Earth. Julian Assange was supposed to be there. He wasn't. You stood up. This is the beginning of what you said.
Hello to all my friends and fans in domestic and international surveillance. I'm here today because I believe that we can make a better world.
And what did you go on to say?
Basically, I went on to talk about how I feel that people like Bill need to come forward to talk about what the U.S. government is doing so that we can make informed choices as a democracy. And I went on to talk about how WikiLeaks is a part of making that happen. And as long as we have excessive classification and secrecy, that we need a WikiLeaks, and we need to stand in solidarity together so that people will have the information that they need to understand what's actually happening in their names.
You mentioned the TOR project that you work with. What is it?
The TOR project is an anonymity network which ensures that each person has the right to read without restriction and the right to speak freely with no exception.
T-O-R?
TOR project.org. And the basic idea is that every person in the world has the right to read and the right to speak freely. And using this software, using principles of mutual aid and solidarity, something familiar to Democracy Now! Viewers, I imagine, it's possible for everybody to use this anonymity network spread out across the planet. It's a thing that's useful for resisting so-called lawful interception. So, for example, when Mubarak in Egypt wants to wiretap someone, they only see an activist talking to the Tor network. They don't see that person connecting to Twitter. And that is something that can be used by everybody, everywhere, to resist so-called lawful interception.
And you use a program that was actually developed by the U.S. government?
Well, yeah. So originally, the Tor project is born from ideas that come from the anonymity community, of which the U.S. military has actually contributed quite heavily to. But since the times of the original onion routing patents, it has become a free software project where, as far as I know, the U.S. Navy has contributed zero lines of code to it, but certainly lots of good ideas, because they understand, as many other people do, that if everyone has anonymous communication, that means everyone does. And if only special people do, it means that you can tell that those are special people that have special privileges, and you can basically see who they are. So, for example, the Rise Up Collective, which you mentioned earlier in the show, they run a number of Tor nodes, and I run some, and many other people do. And as long as you get one good one, you have some of the properties that you need. And this helps people to resist not just so-called lawful interception, but also to resist censorship. So you can't see inside of the communications. You can't selectively discriminate based on the content.
Just to say that in our news headlines today, we said the FBI has just seized a computer server at the New York facility shared by the internet organization Rise Up Networks and May First People Link. But I'm going to go back to your experience at the airport. If you could just briefly say, I mean, it's been dozens and dozens of times that you have—
I don't fly as much as Laura, and Laura's been at it for a lot longer than I have. But in the period of time since they started detaining me, around a dozen-plus times— I've been detained a number of times. The first time I was actually detained by the Immigration Customs Enforcement. I was put into a special room where they frisked me, put me up against the wall. One guy cupped me in a particularly uncomfortable way. Another one held my wrists. They took my cell phones. I'm not really actually able to talk about what happened to those next.
Why?
Because we don't live in a free country. And if I did, I guess I could tell you about it, huh? And they took my laptop, but they gave it back. They were a little surprised it didn't have a hard drive. I guess that threw them for a loop. And, you know, then they interrogated me, denied me access to a lawyer. And when they did the interrogation, they had a member of the U.S. Army on American soil. And they refused to let me go. They tried to, they tried their usual scare tactics. So they sort of implied that if I didn't make a deal with them, that I'd be sexually assaulted in prison, you know, which is the thing that they do these days, as a method of punitive punishment, and they, of course, suggest that that would happen. Well, you know, they say, you know, computer hackers like to think they're all tough, but really when it comes down to it, you don't look like you're going to do so good in prison. You know, that kind of stuff.
And what was the main thrust of the questions they were asking you?
Well, they wanted to know about my political views. They wanted to know about my work in any capacity as a journalist, actually. The notion that I could be in some way associated with Julian, they wanted basically to know
any—
Julian Assange, the one and only. And they wanted essentially to ask me questions about the Iraq War, the Afghan War, what I thought politically. They didn't ask me anything about terrorism. They didn't ask me anything about smuggling or drugs or any of the customs things that you would expect customs to be doing. They didn't ask me if I had anything to declare about taxes, for example, or about importing things. They did it purely for political reasons and to intimidate me, denied me a lawyer. They gave me water but refused me a bathroom, and to give you an idea about what they were doing.
What happened to your Twitter account?
Well, the U.S. government, as I learned while I was in Iceland, actually, sent what's called an administrative subpoena, or a 2703D order. And this is essentially less than a search warrant, and it asserts that you can get just the metadata and that the third party really doesn't have a standing to challenge it, although in our case we were very lucky in that we got to have—Twitter actually did challenge it, which was really wonderful. And we have been fighting this in court, and without going into too much detail about the current court proceedings, we lost a stay recently, which says that Twitter has to give the data to the government. Twitter did, as I understand it, produce that data, I was told. And that metadata actually paints, you know, metadata in aggregate is content, and it paints a picture. So that's all the IP addresses I logged in from. It's all of the, you know, communications that are about my communications, which is Bill's specialty, and he can, I'm sure, talk about how dangerous that metadata is.
Well, I wanted to ask William Binney about this issue. When it comes to snail mail, the old postal system, it's very tough for the government to intercept mail, except in times of war, particular situations. When it comes to phone conversations, land phone conversations, you need a warrant to be able to intercept phone conversations. But what about email, and what about the communication now that is really the dominant form that not only Americans, but many people around the world are communicate? What are the restrictions on the government in terms of email?
Well, after some of the laws they passed, like the Patriot Act and their secret interpretation of Section 215, which is my view, of course, is the same as Tom Drake's, is that that gives him license to take all the commercially held data about us, which is exceedingly dangerous, because if you take that and put it into forms of graphing, which is building relationships or social networks for everybody, and then you watch it over time, you can build up knowledge about everyone in the country. And having that knowledge then allows them the ability to concoct all kinds of charges if they want to target you. Like in my case, they fabricated several charges and attempted to indict us on them. Fortunately, we were able to produce evidence that would make them look very silly in court, so they didn't do it. In fact, I was basically assembling evidence of malicious prosecution, which was a countercharge to them. So,
do you believe all emails the government has copies of in the United States?
I believe they have most of them, yes.
And you're speaking from a position where you would know, considering your position in the National Security Agency.
Right. All they would have to do is put various NARIS devices at various points along the network, at choke points or convergent points where the network converges, and they could basically take down and have copies of most everything on the network.
Jacob, your email?
Well, I selectively chose to use certain public services like Sonic.net and Gmail, and I specifically did that so as to serve as a warning to other people. I didn't use it for anything interesting. Never once emailed Julian, for example, from those accounts. But the U.S. government, again, asserted in those cases, according to the Wall Street Journal, which is one way to find out about what's going on with you, they asserted that they have the right to all that metadata. And it is possible. On Monday, I had a little interaction with the FBI where they sort of hinted that maybe there might be a national security letter for one of my email accounts, which is also hosted by Google, specifically because I want to serve as a canary in the coal mine for other people.
A national security letter. It's believed the government has given out hundreds of thousands of those.
Yeah.
I have also written about NSLs. But if you get one, you are not allowed to talk about it on pain of something like up to 5 years in prison, even to mention that you were handed a national security letter that said turn something over.
That was the case of Nick Merrill, for example, who's a brave American who essentially fought and won the NSL that was handed down to him.
And the librarians of Connecticut who
yes.
were taking on the USA Patriot Act and didn't want to give information over about patrons in the library that the FBI wanted to get information on.
Right, absolutely. So in NSL, what's specifically scary about it is that all that is required is for an FBI agent to assert that they need one, and that's it. And you don't have a chance to have judicial review because you aren't the one served. Your service provider will be served, and they can't tell you, so you don't get your day in court.
Laura, can you set up this clip that
yeah,
we have?
Yeah, actually, it's what Jake was alluding to. On Monday, there was a panel at the Open Society Institute, and there was a deputy general counsel of the FBI who was present, and Jake had the opportunity to question her about national security letters.
Are you including national security letters in your comment about believing that there is judicial oversight with the FBI's actions?
National security letters, administrative subpoenas have the ability to have judicial oversight, yes.
How many of those actually do have judicial oversight in percentage?
What do you mean by that? How many have?
Every time you get a national security letter, you have to go to a judge? Or?
No. As you well know, national security letters, just like administrative subpoenas, you don't have to go to a judge. The statute does allow for the person on whom those are served to seek judicial review. And people have done so.
And in the case of the third parties, such as, say, the 2703D orders that were served on my, according to the Wall Street Journal, my Gmail account, my Twitter account,
and my internet service provider account, the third parties were prohibited from telling me about it. So how am I supposed to go to a judge if the third party is gagged from telling me that I'm targeted by you?
There are times when we have to have those things in place. So at some point, obviously, you became aware. So at some point, the person does become aware. But yes, the statute does allow us to do that. The statute allows us.
Now, Jacob, explain who she was again.
So my understanding is that she's the Deputy General Counsel of the FBI.
And the significance of what she has just said?
Essentially, what she says is, we are just and righteous because you get judicial review. But there are some cases where you don't, and we are still just and righteous. And you should trust us, because COINTELPRO will never happen again. That's what I heard from that. And in fact, later, someone asked about COINTELPRO and said, how
can we— The counterintelligence program that targeted so many dissidents in the 1970s.
Tried to get Martin Luther King Jr. to kill himself, for example. The FBI wrote him a letter and encouraged him to commit suicide. So for her to suggest that it is just and right and that we should always trust them sort of overlooks the historical problems with doing exactly that for any people in a position of power with no judicial oversight.
William Binning, what about the companies that are approached by the government to participate or facilitate the surveillance? Your sense of the degree of opposition that they're mounting, if at all, and also, has there been any kind of qualitative change since the Obama administration came in versus what the Bush administration was practicing?
Well, first of all, I don't think any of them opposed it in any way. I mean, they were approached to saying, you'll be patriotic if you support us. So I think they saluted and said, yes, sir, and supported them, because they were told it was legal, too. And then, of course, they had to be given retroactive immunity for the crimes they were committing.
And approved by President Obama.
and President Bush, yeah. It started with Bush, yeah.
And the differences in the administrations?
Actually, I think the surveillance has increased. In fact, I would suggest that they've assembled on the order of 20 trillion transactions about U.S. citizens with other U.S. citizens.
How many?
20 trillion.
And you're saying that this surveillance has increased, not only the—
Yes.
Targeting of whistleblowers like your colleagues, like people like Tom Drake, who are actually indicted under the Obama administration.
Right.
More times, the number of people who've been indicted are more than all presidents combined in the past.
Right. And I think it's to silence what's going on. But the point is the data that's being assembled is about everybody. From that data, then they can target anyone they want.
Bill Binney, talk about Bluffdale, Utah. What is being built there?
Well, a very large storage device, basically, for remote interrogation and remote processing. That's the way I view that, because there's not enough people there to actually work the data there. So it's being worked somewhere else.
Where do you get the number 20 trillion?
Just by the numbers of telecoms, it appears to me, from the questions that CNET posed to them in 2006, and they published the names and what the responses were, I looked at that and said that anybody that equivocated was participating, and then estimated from that the numbers of transactions. That, by the way, estimate only was involving phone calls and emails. It didn't involve any queries on the net. Or any assembles, any financial transactions or credit card stuff, if they're assembling that. I do not know that.
And
okay.
the original allegations that you made in terms of the crimes being committed under the Bush administration in terms of the rights of American citizens, could you
detail those? Well, I made that. I reported the crime when I was raided in 2007. And it was that Bush and Cheney and Hayden and Tenet conspired to subvert the Constitution and violate various laws of that existed, the statutes at the time. And here's how they did it. And I was reporting this to the FBI on my back porch during the raid. and I went through Stellar Wind and told them what it did and what the information it was using and how they were spying on or assembling data to be able to spy on any American.
I want to go to a clip of Congressmember Hank Johnson. He's the Georgia Democrat, questioning National Security Administration Director General Keith Alexander last month, asking him whether the NSA spies on U.S. citizens.
Does the NSA routinely intercept American citizens' emails?
No.
Does the NSA intercept Americans' cell phone conversations?
No.
Google searches?
No.
Text messages?
No.
Amazon.com orders?
No.
Bank records?
No.
What judicial consent is required for NSA to intercept communications and information involving American citizens?
Within the United States, that would be the FBI lead. If it was a foreign actor in the United States, the FBI would still have the lead and could work that with NSA or other intelligence agencies as authorized. But to conduct that kind of collection in the United States, it would have to go through a court order, and the court would have to authorize it. We're not authorized to do it, nor do we do it.
That was General Keith Alexander, the NSA director, being questioned by Democratic Congressmember Hank Johnson. Bill Binney, he's the head of your agency, of the NSA. You explain what he's saying, what he's not saying as well.
Well, I think it's part of it is a term, how you use the term intercept, as to whether or not what they're saying is we aren't actually looking at it, but we have it, you know, or whether or not they're actually collecting it and storing it somewhere.
So the mistake of the congressman was not to ask, are you collecting information?
Well, he also said things like, we don't collect, or we don't collect against U.S. citizens unless we have a warrant. And then at the same time, he said that we don't, at the same interview, he said we don't have the capability to collect inside this country. Well, those are kind of contradictory.
Is he lying? Is General Keith Alexander lying?
I wouldn't—you know, the point is how you split the words. I wouldn't say lying. It's kind of avoiding the issue.
Jacob Applebaum, how does this relate to you, and how powerful is General Keith Alexander?
I was saying to Bill that I think he's probably the most powerful person in the world in the sense that—
More powerful than President Obama?
Well, sure. I mean, if he controls the information that arrives on Obama's desk and Obama makes decisions based on the things on his desk, what decisions can he make except the decisions presented to him by the people he trusts? And when the people he trusts are the military makes the decisions, then the civilian government is not actually in power.
Bill Binney, you're nodding your head.
Yes. For example, their responsibility is to interpret what they have and report up echelon. So, I mean, that's the responsibility of all the intelligence agencies. So they basically filter the information to what they believe is important, which is what they should do, because, you know, they're occupied. It takes time for leaders to review material to make decisions. So they have to boil it down as best they can. So it's a function of their processing, but it is important that they do it correctly to make sure the information that gets there is correct and complete.
Is General Alexander more powerful than President Obama?
In the sense of presenting information for decision making, sure.
And Laura, the impact on journalists who have to go through what you've gone through the last few years just to be able to report what's going on with our government, the chilling effect that this has on maybe not on you, but on many other journalists.
Sure. I mean, I feel like I can't talk about the work that I do in my home, in my place of work, on my telephone, and sometimes in my country. So it's the chilling effect is huge. It's enormous.
Do you keep your computers and telephones away from conversations you're having in a room?
Yeah, when we had a meeting with you, remember we told you we kicked all your cell phones and all your computers out of the room?
The wired phone, you unwired. Yeah. My cell phone, you didn't allow me to have it in the room, mm-hmm. and you made sure there were no computers
right.
in the room.
Right, because we wanted to talk about—because we were bringing William to New York— And
we have to leave it there, but we're going to go online right now at democracynow.org. We're going to continue this conversation with Bill Binney of the NSA, formerly with MNSA, Laura Poitras, and Jacob Applebaum, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Democracy Now! Is a listener-supported grassroots global news hour. You make it possible when you donate at democracynow.org. Thank you so much.